May the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart always be acceptable to you, Lord, my strength and my redeemer. Amen. What's in a name? This quote from Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet is probably known by everyone in this room. Juliet argues that Romeo's identity as a Montagu does not define him, change who he truly is. I like to believe that this is true, but for me at least, I am influenced by the label given to a person or an event. To be honest, the title Good Friday, used to identify the day of Jesus' execution, has never felt right. I must remind myself that the modern understanding of the word good is different from the time the term Good Friday came into use. At that time, good connoted a sense of piousness or holiness. Holy Friday or Sacred Friday are better names for this day. Knowing how the story ends with the resurrection is an impediment to listening to the gospel story of Good Friday. My sense of absolute horror of this day for Jesus, his followers, his family, is mitigated. Contributing to this feeling of detached empathy are the sanitized versions of our creeds that bluntly state that he suffered under Pontius Pilate, was crucified, died, and was buried. The use of the past tense, the dry clinical language, just skims over the surface. We need to really focus, pray, and reflect to be drawn into the reality of the day. Today's gospel is one of a struggle and the between and the exercise of various conflicting powers. In Jesus, we have divine power. This was evident in the time of the arrest. Jesus replies to the soldiers, "I am he," a statement that mirrors Yahweh's "I am" when asked his name in the book of Exodus. The soldiers and temple police step back, falling to the ground in acknowledgement of the presence of the divine. The conflicting powers of Imperial Rome and the Jewish religious leaders are central to the gospel, acknowledging that both are committed to maintaining the status quo. In this narrative, as this narrative unfolds, neither power is in control. They jockey back and forth, trying to force the other to solve the problem of what to do about Jesus of Nazareth. Lastly, there is the power of the people, recognized and feared by Pilate and Caiaphas. Both feared riots and rebellion. It was that power base that forced Pilate's hand. Having said this, I invite you to consider which power was in control of the event. Who controlled the narrative of the trial? Divine power. At St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, on the right-hand side as you enter the church, is a large white marble statue or sculpture of Mary holding her dead son Jesus. We all know this image, Michelangelo's Pietà, meaning pity or compassion in Italian. I've seen it, and it is truly a wonder. And yet, for me, it fails to convey the reality of the events. It is another block to understanding the experiences of the day. One sees Mary sitting powerfully erect, void of emotion, looking pensively, peacefully into her dead son's face. Mary would have been in her 40s, but she is portrayed as a very young woman, wearing upper-class clothing. Her son has been betrayed, humiliated, tortured, and murdered. She was there at the cross and heard his last gasp. The world has now totally collapsed around her. Yet there is no sign of distress, no wrinkled brow, no hollowed-out, tear-stained cheeks or puffy eyes. There is no acknowledgement of the years of fearing for the safety of her child. There is no sense of her immense grief. Then there is the suffering and pain of Jesus. Jesus was human. He suffered horrible psychic and physical pain while continuing to minister and serve his community. One of his disciples had sold him out. Then Peter denied him three times. Although predicted, the sting of betrayal must have been inexpressible. And what of Peter? He followed Jesus to the courtyard of the high priest with another disciple, an act of courage. Yet, when identified as a disciple, he responded in fear and cowardice, this horrible, shameful action. Lastly, there was the betrayal of the people, the ones who had welcomed Jesus 5 days earlier by laying their garments and branches over the road, entering Jesus. They called for his execution. Betrayed to the core. Concurrently, we have examples of incredible bravery. I've already mentioned the presence of Peter and the other disciples in the courtyard of the high priest. Consider the three Marys: Mary, mother of Jesus; Mary Magdalene, also known as the apostle to the apostles; and Mary, the wife of Clopas. The three Marys, along with the unnamed disciple whom he loved, in their fear and grief, remained with Jesus to his death. They were there, surrounded by onlookers, Roman soldiers, and presumably temple officials. They heard the taunts, which witnessed the torture. They heard his cries of agony and his words of love and compassion. I suspect that they were also insulted, threatened, and spat upon by the crowd. Their love of Jesus overcame their fear. Consider all their inner turmoil, the pain, the confusion, the loss of purpose, the loss of a deeply loved one. Their world had ended. Joseph of Arimathea is a compelling character who stepped out of fear to serve. He was a secret disciple of Jesus, a man of wealth, influence, and access. Jesus was dead, and his cause had been crushed. Jesus' followers were hiding in terror. At considerable personal risk, Joseph contacted Pilate for permission to retrieve Jesus' body. He then honored his friend and prepared his body with Nicodemus for burial in the new tomb Joseph had constructed for himself. Such a dark, frightening, and horrible time, and yet Joseph acted out of love. Love. Jesus was the embodiment of love and empathy in this narrative. Jesus protected his companions in the garden, saving them from arrest and injury. Jesus, the peacemaker, stopped the potential riot. He healed a slave's right ear. He forgave one of the criminals. And just before Jesus' death, there was a profound display of love. Jesus saw his mother beneath him and compassionately arranged for her well-being. He called the disciple whom he loved to care for her as if she was his mother. His last thoughts were on the welfare of others. I have regularly inserted poetry in my homilies. One of the practices here at Grace that resonates with me is the inclusion of poetry in the bulletin. I love looking for and finding the appropriate poem for the readings and the pull of the Spirit when I preach. Today's poem, written in the present tense, using the personal pronoun I, hopefully will put and keep you in that moment. Here's an invitation to be active listeners and observers in the events of Holy Friday some 2,000 years ago. In the time we have for contemplation following this sermon, I invite you to place yourself in this poem and reading it slowly, ending with, "I wait at the foot of the cross to begin my journey home." And for the coming days, as you wait at the foot of the cross, remain focused on the sacred truth of our readings from today. May that truth truly prepare you for the holy world evident in Easter. Amen.